Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is John Katko. He's the Republican, Conservative, and Independence Party challenger to Congressman Dan Maffei in the 24th District this November. He recently stepped down from a federal prosecutor position in order to run. A note about our conversation today. I had hoped to have both Mr. Katko and Dan Maffei on the program at the same time. I originally invited them to appear during a week when Congress was not in active session. I told each candidate that in the event that only one of them accepted my invitation, I would go forward with an individual interview. Mr. Katko accepted my invitation, but unfortunately Dan Maffei declined without citing a reason. So I am going forward with an individual interview with Mr. Katko at a time of our mutual convenience. Note also that further into the campaign cycle, I will extend another similar invitation to both candidates in the hopes that we can convince both of them to appear together on a later program. So, John, welcome to the program, and thanks for being willing to talk to me with or without your opponent.
Thanks, Grant. I appreciate you having me on.
Let me start with this one. You're a lawyer, and you're challenging an incumbent. So give me a very brief legal brief on why you think voters should not return Dan Maffei to office.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. It starts with jobs, the economy, failed leadership, and the failure really on both sides of the aisle in Congress to address the looming major issues, including fixing the entitlement programs and fixing the budgets and fixing, more importantly, the debt. It's crippling our country, and it's really a ticking time bomb. And the fact that no one's on either side is willing to address it, to me, is enough for me to get into this race.
And what do you see in particular about Congressman Maffei's lack of leadership on this issue? Could you give me some more specifics about what he's not done that you would like to have seen him doing?
Well, I'd like to often answer a question with a question, but I guess more importantly is what has he done? What has he done in regard to addressing any of the issues I just cited, especially the debt? He's done nothing. And that's, you know, that's a microcosm of what the Democrats in general are doing, and that is they're not addressing the 800-pound elephant in the room, and that is the debt, and it's the deficit spending, and it is the inability to address any one of those two things.
Let me ask you about the debt and the deficit spending. It is high. It is high by historical measures, but at least in the last few years, that deficit has now started to come down, and there was a recent report from the CBO showing that. So you tell me why that trend isn't something that you would look to and say, here's some progress.
Well, there's two things, and you can't mix them. It's like mixing apples and oranges. The first thing is there's deficit spending. So deficit spending as a percentage of the budget may be going down, but our debt is still skyrocketing out of control. And the debt now is approaching $18 trillion. And at some point, it becomes almost a national security concern because we're so beholden to foreign countries and foreign bankers, if you will, like China, that at some point, it becomes an issue for not just economic reasons, but for foreign policy reasons, and that is not being addressed. So it's kind of fool's gold to say, well, just because our deficits for this year are a little bit lower than last year as part of the 2013 budget, that things are okay. Well, they're not, because even though that's lower, the debt is still going up, and it's gone up more in the last 5 years than it has under any president than in history.
So that leads into this next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is if you could lay out for me the most significant policy differences between you and Congressman Maffei, what would they be?
I think the most significant policy differences is I'm more of a pragmatist, and I think you have to address the big structural issues. I think he doesn't want to do that. I think he either thinks they're too hard or he just simply doesn't have the stomach for it. But, you know, the most important things in life that you do are often the most difficult. When I took on the gang task force, everybody saw gang issues in this city as insurmountable, and trying to bring together multiple agencies to work on the issue as not going to happen. We made it happen. And I think that I take that same mentality to Washington and say, look, you know, the Democrats and Republicans haven't been getting along lately. Well, I've got to go down and make that happen. We got to stop calling each other names. Stop trying to just do the toe the party line and try and sit down and have a reasonable discussion about how to address this, because any rational politician will tell you that the debt is a huge issue in this country, but nobody has an answer to it. Sitting down together is a way to do it.
And if you were to be elected, what kinds of issue areas would you put most of your attention on? Would it be the debt? Would that be your primary number one issue that you?
Well, at least bringing light to it, yes, absolutely, because that, you know, really is the future of our country. And I have three teenage boys, and I really worry about the future we're leaving our children. For every working American in this country right now, we're on the hook for $150,000 in debt, almost that. That's a stunning amount when you really think about it. And with that, what are we leaving our kids? So that is absolutely one of the things I'm going to be working on when I get down there for sure is the debt. I'm also, you know, there's other things I'd like to work on, veterans issues for one for sure, which is a major issue in this country and it's becoming a bigger issue, and several other things. But the debt is primary job one.
And do you have an idea of what committees you might try to get placed on?
Oh, sure. Well, based on my background, I definitely would love to get on the Judiciary Committee. I've 20 years in the Department of Justice. There's many things I've seen that I'd like to change. But I'd also like to get in on something that has to do with the budget or appropriations to try and have a voice in that for Central New York.
Now, give me an idea of some of the specific things you might want to push in order to attack the debt. I mean, you've talked about how big a problem it is, and I think there's general agreement on that. But what do you do? Because you've only got a few mechanisms here. There's taxes. There's deeper spending cuts. So what are you thinking there?
I think you have to look at everything in spending and look at it in the light of do we need this? Mitt Romney had a great line, I thought, in one of his debates when he said, "I'm going to look at everything in the budget and make a determination based on this simple test. Is it worth borrowing money from China to pay for it?" And I think if you use that maxim, you'll have a much more discerning eye towards government spending. I spent 20 years working with the Department of Justice, and I can see firsthand that there's areas and ways we could be leaner and meaner and cut more things, especially in Washington bureaucracy, and save some money. But you know what? The hard question is, and another thing that my opponent doesn't ever want to discuss or debate except demagogue it, and that is the entitlement programs. I don't want them to go away. I want them to be here for future generations. And I think it's completely irresponsible that no one's taking a look at them. We need to fix them going forward so that our future generations will have the advantage of these same programs that we have. Everybody you talk to that's in their 30s or 40s, or even my age, in the early 50s, most of them are banking on the fact that Social Security is no longer going to be there. That we don't want that to happen. We want the opposite. So we got to fix that, too. That's got to be part of the discussion.
So you've brought up a few third rails in American politics here. You've mentioned, you know, your openness to thinking about the entitlement programs. The other one, of course, is taxes. So are you open to thinking about different kinds of revenue sources that might help to fix this problem as well?
I'm never going to say never to anything, but I don't think that should even be remotely discussed. Unless we're in a crisis mode. And quite frankly, I don't want it to be said at the end of this discussion that I'm into higher tax. No way. I think that that's always an easy way out. The hard way out is to roll up our sleeves like our forefathers did and make the tough decisions. And as far as the third rail goes with entitlements, that's one of the problems I have with politics. Every time you say you want to fix entitlements, everyone says, "Oh, my God, you want to throw grandma out on the street and let her starve to death." Well, that's ridiculous. My parents are on social programs. They're on Social Security. They have Medicaid and Medicare, okay? I want it there for them, and I don't want it to be worse for them. There's ways to work on it and ways to fix it, and we're very smart people as a country. We can find ways to fix it together, but not separately.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with John Katko, Republican, Conservative, and Independence Party candidate for the 24th District Congressional seat, currently held by Dan Maffei. Well, you've never held elected office before. You've never worked in or served in a legislature, to my knowledge. That's correct. So why do you think you would be effective in this role?
I think our system of government was set up not for career politicians, but for citizen politicians. And I think that one of the problems with our current system of government is that too many people are making politics a career. When you rely on being a representative of your people as your career, I think you make decisions that are ultimately self-serving. And I think that's dangerous. And I don't think that's good for the country. And I think, quite frankly, I think my opponent does that. I'm not that. I've had my career. I want to go down to Washington for the right reasons. I want to serve for however long they need me. And I'll make decisions based on what the people need and not on what I need.
Can you give me an example or two of the decisions you think that Congressman Maffei has made that have been more self-serving?
Sure. He moved to Washington. He lives there. I will never do that. That's one.
Anything else?
Sure. I think that a lot of times he votes based on pressures from his party, and you see that in his handling of Obamacare is a good example. He voted for Obamacare. He's on record of admitting he never read the bill before he voted for it, which to me is the ultimate irresponsibility. once a bill was passed, he saw what's happened with some of its impacts on Central New York. He's starting to run from it. He's moving to repeal portions of the very bill he voted for after he saw that Welch Allyn lost 200 jobs. That's an example of what I'm talking about.
Now, the work that you've done up until now, it seems to me, has a certain quality to it. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they're all inside of each other. There's closure. How do you think that you would adjust to this never-ending crawl of Congress?
Well, I tell you what, the cases I did over the course of my year were organized crime cases, and they're generally viewed as the most difficult and long cases in a prosecutor's career. There's two types of cases that you prosecute. There's reactive cases, where you react to a crime that's already been committed, and proactive, where you actually go after and put together a case to go after criminal conduct over a period of time. That takes patience. It takes determination. It takes will. It takes not giving up. And some of my cases take 2, 3 years, 4 years to do. But we've done 7 of those gang cases here in Syracuse alone, not to mention political corruption cases I've done elsewhere in the district. So it serves you very well, I think, for what I'm getting into, because you have to have that type of steely determination to see it through no matter what.
How well do you think the Republican Party in the House of Representatives currently functions? The public in general gives them a very low rating.
Well, I'm not sure I give them a low rating, but I think that they have part of the problems in Congress are at their feet, too. And there's no question about that. And I think that for someone to toe the strict party line and say it's all the other side's fault is borderline childish, and it's just not – it's ignoring the facts. Both sides are wrong for not sitting down with each other. There's no question about it. I happen to think that the leadership in this country, the real failure is at the top. And I say that in President Obama. He's a very polarizing figure, and I basically – it's his agenda or forget it. And I look at two well-respected presidents in our not-too-distant past, Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. They both had strong people on the other side. Clinton had Newt Gingrich, and Reagan had Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill and Reagan were titans of their parties. They found a way to get along, and they found it through leadership. And so did Clinton, and so did Gingrich. We don't have that now. It starts at the top. But then you know what? Both sides and the Democratic and Republican side are responsible for the gridlock in Washington, and neither one have clean hands in it.
Now, you've emphasized this need for more cross-party work and cooperation. So are there some Democrats in the House right now that have caught your eye that if you were to go to Congress, you'd reach out to, try to partner with on issues that you'd be looking to generate some of those cross-party collaborations?
I'd work with any Democrat that wants to listen. I'm not going to single out individuals. I'll sit down and talk to any of them, and I'll certainly try with all of them. You know, I think that's – you have to go down with that mentality. And you can't go down there thinking, I have to do right and I have to do this to make sure the party likes me so that I can get reelected. You can't go down with the mentality. You can have the mentality that I'm going to do the best I can for my district and put the jobs of my constituents before my own job security.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with John Katko. He's the Republican, Conservative, and Independence Party candidate for the 24th District Congressional seat. I had also invited the incumbent, Dan Maffei, to join us in this conversation, but he declined my invitation without providing a reason. One of the things I think that the moderate and middle-of-the-road voters in this district are going to be trying to figure out about you in the next few months is just where you stand relative to your party. You've given some hints of that, I think, already in our conversation. But they'll be asking questions like, how genuinely moderate is he? How conservative is he? The Maffei campaign's already painting you as Tea Party-ish. So where are you? Would you consider yourself to be a moderate Republican? Is that a fair description?
I don't want to give myself a label. I can only tell you what I am. I'm a fiscal conservative. I think I'm basically a social conservative, but I'm also a pragmatist. By that, I mean I want to get the job done. And you look at Ronald Reagan. Went back to him once before. Ronald Reagan's – one of his famous sayings was, I'll take 60% now and I'll keep working on the other 40%. That's a good way to go into attitude going to Congress with. And I got to say something about my opponent constantly trying to call me a Tea Partier. He's trying that because he's trying to be divisive. And that is a good example of him not wanting to really engage in the issues. He's trying to label me as some Tea Party conservative. I've never said I was a Tea Partier. No one's ever said I was a Tea Partier except him. And I think it's really irresponsible for him to try and do that type of labeling. And that doesn't serve the public at all. I mean, that's a way to avoid discussion of the issues. And quite frankly, he's a master at avoiding discussing the issues. He says he's for the middle class. but he doesn't explain what that means. And, you know, those type of labels, you know, they're not productive in politics. And they're a good sign that he's into the divisiveness and he'll carry the party line instead of trying to do the hard work that needs to be done to fix this country.
So let me try this again. I doubt I'm going to get very far there, but I'm going to try. So let me give you two specific examples. Maybe you can tell me if you're closer to one than the other.
Sure.
Richard Hanna, Anne-Marie Berkel. Which one are you closer to there?
I don't know. There's qualities of both of them that I like, and there's qualities of both of them that I don't agree with. So I'm not going to pigeonhole myself.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the middle class just a second ago, and I wanted to ask you a question that's related to that in a way. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are emphasizing and have been emphasizing the middle class in their rhetoric quite a bit. You hear it all the time. However, Syracuse has a very high poverty rate, and one could argue that the city's most pressing problem is not the challenges to the middle class, but it's poor. So what can the federal government do about poverty?
What the federal government can do about poverty, first and foremost, the federal government's never going to let Americans starve. And I think that we have a moral responsibility to take care of those that are less advantaged. I think we do them a disservice, though, when we try and say the government's going to do this for you and the government's going to do that for you. What the government can do is create the stimulus to create jobs and economic opportunity for these people. The people that are struggling, that are out of work, that are poor, they want economic opportunity. They want to better themselves. They want to have a better future for their children. You can't do that when businesses are choking. I've spent about 3 or 4 weeks here basically going to every single business in central New York, talking to them and seeing what makes them tick. And a couple of things have come true to me. We're the highest tax state in the union. It's one of the least friendly business environments in the union and in the United States. And it's not going to – you cannot help the disadvantaged when you have that economic matrix. One sad reality is some of the most successful companies here are homegrown companies. And they're successful because despite the odds and the ridiculous tax burdens and power rates that we have in this state, they're doing okay. But the sad reality is, if they didn't have family roots here, most of those companies would take the money and go to the Virginias or North Carolinas. They're offering all kinds of incentives to go there. We have to be more competitive here in central New York as a general theme. My concern is what's already happened in New York State is starting to happen nationally, and that is thinking that business is bad and taxing them to death is the way to get ourselves out of this hole. And I'll give you an example. Pfizer, one of the iconic American companies, is moving out of the United States because the taxes in the United States are some of the highest in the industrialized world. And if we simply lowered the tax rates nationwide, we would repatriate over $1 trillion in corporate earnings and businesses in the world. Those types of things, I think, will help get the disadvantage some opportunities that they don't have now, because there's a chronic problem with unemployment, but also the big dark thing that no one talks about is underemployment. So many people in this country are underemployed, and we need to create the business environment for them to flourish.
You were talking about lowering tax rates overall. I assume you meant the corporate tax rates in that context, correct?
Well, I mean, I think that for the income tax rates, too, are choking us here in New York State. And I think anybody that does their taxes will tell you that. You can lower the corporate tax rates. I'm not saying – I have no interest in making corporate owners or business owners wealthy. I have interest in having their businesses flourish. And I think that if you lower the corporate tax rates and close the loopholes, you're probably going to have at least as much revenue as you would otherwise, and you would attract a heck of a lot more companies back to the United States and keep those here in New York State as well.
Now, you mentioned pragmatism several points earlier. The pundits are putting a very high probability on the Senate going over to the Republican majority this fall. So let's just imagine that happens. Will you enlist in another set of efforts with your party colleagues to roll back Obamacare at that point? Because that's probably going to be one of the outcomes of that change.
Well, I don't know if you say roll back or what, but I've talked to enough people to know that Obamacare is a mess. And they tout the 8 million people that are on Obamacare. Well, 6 million of those are people that had their insurance policies canceled when Obamacare went into effect. So it's nowhere near the raging success that they said. And I think that when you look at Obamacare, if it was so divinely conceived, why is it that Obama on his own has made the decision not to implement the mandate for employers to provide insurance? Why did he delay that till after the elections? Okay, he sees a ticking time bomb. That is for small businesses. There's a lot of good parts about Obamacare. Every American should have health insurance if we can make it happen. Absolutely. And there's, for example, having up to 26-year-old have insurance, great. There's some good parts of it. But quite frankly, it was so thrown together and was so ill-conceived that I'm not sure it can be fixed. And I would like to sit down with both sides and have an honest bipartisan effort to find a replacement for it that works. And I'm not saying throw it out and forget about it. Let's find something that works. And like I said, Congressman Maffei did not read the bill before it was passed, and a vast majority of congressmen didn't. Let's find a bill that they read ahead of time, they know what's in, and then get something that's going to work for Americans long term.
So let's imagine, I want to pursue this a bit, because this seems to me to go right in the face of the realities of the way that Washington works right now. So I'm curious to see how you see this playing out. Let's imagine that this happens and that you could have a conversation in Congress that would result in some kind of significant change. You know right now that that is going to get vetoed by the president, even if we could imagine that something like that would get passed, which I don't think it ever will. And that veto is not going to be overturned. So this just seems like an exercise in pointlessness.
You say that, but I think that enough of the Democrats are running away from Obamacare as an issue in this election as it is, that you need 10 more votes, right? I think it is to overturn a majority in the Senate. You need 60 votes, I believe it is, isn't it?
You're talking about getting something through the Senate.
Overcoming a veto. So I don't subscribe to the thought that there's some Democrats won't cross party lines to do this. And it's incumbent upon us as leaders to get a bill that everyone supports instead of having one like this that is just a mess.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is John Katko. He's challenging Dan Maffei for the 24th congressional district seat. Well, let's talk about the campaign itself for a little bit. The most recent reports of fundraising that I've seen show you trailing the congressman by quite a large margin. Now, if outside money pours into this race again, like it did in the last two elections, that kind of spending could be much larger than the internal money that either of you would raise. But I imagine that the concern for your campaign is that if you don't raise enough money yourself early on, then that outside money won't ever come into this race. So it's a bit of a catch-22 for you. How are you dealing with that?
Oh, we've got a great financing team together. Our finance chairman, if you will, worked on all of Congressman Walsh's 10 congressional campaigns, and all of them. He was the man who helped get him over the top. We have an unbelievable experienced amount of people on it. So, and over the next 6 weeks, we are going to have a tremendous number of high-quality fundraisers. The last week alone, I took in $50,000 in donations. So we are going to hit our mark. And here's what's important about that. The Republican National Committee has targeted our race as one of the top races in the country that they think that we can win against an incumbent. And we're on what's called on the radar, which means we're definitely a race to look at. And if we get a certain benchmark by the end of June, then we're going to be what's called a young gun, which means we're going to get the top amount of support from the national party and from leaders all over the country. And that's great. But, you know, make no mistake about it. We're doing this with local money, unlike our opponent. And if you really go down the FEC filing list, you'll see the percentage of money coming from local people as opposed to national people is stunning the difference. Okay, this is an organic, homegrown operation, and we are going to hit our mark at the end of June, and we're going to be extremely competitive money-wise, and we're going to be more, financially savvy with how we use our money. Mr. Maffei's campaign is riddled with people from out of state, and his campaign manager is from Georgia. And, he doesn't even have his campaign manager is not even from here. Our entire campaign is Syracuse and homegrown. And that's going to help us.
And so this mark that you've got to hit, you're saying you're confident that you will hit it, and then you'll get that attention, and then therefore the outside money you think will come in.
There's virtually no question about it.
Okay. Let's talk about the conversations like the one we're having right now. Again, as I've mentioned, the Campbell Conversations had hoped to have the incumbent here to discuss these issues together, but he declined. In the last election, Dan Maffei only did two joint discussions, debates, whatever it is that we want to call them. And I noticed in his press release this time on agreeing to debates with you, he used the phrase televised debate. So that doesn't leave very many opportunities. So how are you going to try to get him to do more public things where you're both there and you can interact with each other?
We're just going to have to keep asking him. I think, you know, the hallmark of our democracy is fair, open, and honest debate. It's been that way since our country was born. And I think it's really tragic that he's not interested in fair, honest, and open debate. And I don't know why. And I think that's a real problem for him. It's not a problem for me because I'll talk to anyone anytime, anywhere. I spent the morning so far at the farmer's market talking to a group of veterans. And then I went over and honored our fallen heroes at the police memorial with the Syracuse police officers and talked to them. You got to do that on a regular basis. And you got to sit down with your opponent and you have to have a dialogue. And you don't have to scream at each other. But you know what? How can American people make a choice if they don't have the ability to size up the candidates side by side? And the fact that he doesn't want to appear with me probably is a good indication of how he feels about standing side by side with me and letting people compare us.
Now, I want to combine these two things that we've just discussed, put them together. If it's true that you end up having this fundraising disadvantage and the pieces don't come into place exactly as you would like them, and it's also true that you can't get him to publicly engage you directly, this is going to become a race of television ads. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to if people aren't doing things together. And that's going to favor him enormously. So how are you going to effectively challenge him under those circumstances?
Well, you got a couple of assumptions built in there. I am not going to assume. I'm telling you that we're going to meet our mark, and I'm telling you that we're going to have plenty of money for ads. And for lack of a better term, we're going to be highly competitive with the amount of TV ads that we're running. There's just no question about that. So it gets back to the big thing, and that is the debates. And not even just debates. Let's sit down and have a cup of coffee or a beer and talk about things and let people size us up. I don't know why that is such a big hurdle that he can't clear. And again, I ask you, I pose a question again. Why not? And why wouldn't you do that? Don't you want the American people to have some faith that you can handle a little heat?
Let me get to the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
My teenage boys are driving me nuts.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is that I don't need any caffeine and I've got a lot of energy. I just ask everybody in my office.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, I would have to say my work on helping to create the gang task force and all the successes it's had in Syracuse. I've never in my wildest dreams thought we would be this successful dealing with the gang problem in Syracuse. And I'm forever proud of that, and I'm eternally grateful all the great people that I've worked with in that job over the years.
That was John Katko. John, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks. I hope you have me back.
Well, note again that I will attempt to have both candidates together on a future program. Please tune in again to WRVO Public Media for more conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.